Welcome to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and thank you for joining us. Tonight's topic will focus on rebuilding for a better future and provide some Citizens Climate International updates. We're going to be joined by Joe Robertson. So let's introduce Joe. The wonderful Joe Robertson is CCL's Global Strategy Director for Citizens Climate Education and Citizens Climate Lobby. He leads CCE and CCL engagement with our UN climate change negotiations, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, as well as the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition and other multilateral processes. In his role, he's also the lead strategist for the Resilience Intel Climate Smart Finance Initiative. You may have heard of that in the past. I know we've had Joe feature that on prior trainings, as well as the Acceleration Dialogues and the International Climate Dividend Alliance, a wonderful group you've probably never heard of, but hopefully will after tonight understand a little bit more of. And in April, he took on, as if that wasn't enough, the additional role of Commission Director for the Independent Multidisciplinary Food Systems Economics Commission. We'll get to learn a little bit more about that tonight and the wonderful work that it's doing intersectionally with all these other initiatives. But with that, let's jump through the learning objectives and we'll pass it to Joe. We're going to have a chance tonight to do three things. We're going to explore, understand, and envision. We'll explore the convergence of climate, economic, political, health, and financial crises and their international context and why that matters for you. We'll have the chance to understand resilience, what that really means across all of these dimensions, all within 40 minutes, and especially how human experience and the resilience that it has translates into these opportunities we face. And then lastly, we'll be able to be invited to envision a livable future in which collaboration and co-creation shape, secure, and spread health through the prosperity that we'll be creating. So with that, Joe, the floor is yours. Thank you all for making it tonight, and we're so honored for you to be here and really walking us through tonight's training.
Thank you, Brett. I really appreciate that introduction, and I appreciate you all joining me here. And Brett is right. We're going to cover a lot of ground in 40 minutes, and so I will go quickly through these slides. I will not read everything that's on them. You'll be able to access this material later on, but do, you know, bring forward any questions you have. We want to have a robust discussion afterwards. And I just want to pause on this first slide for a minute to point out what those three lines at the bottom right say. That, you know, we're facing multiple converging crises right now, not just in the United States, but around the world. And frankly, as a global community, we are behind the curve in dealing with all of them. But that is not a place for us to essentially despair. That is a place for us to answer a call. We have to reinvent what is possible. We've talked about that a lot in different fora in relation to climate, climate energy, carbon pricing policy, but this is a deeper, broader issue now. And it's important, especially from our international, the perspective of our international work, to understand how these things come together. So that's the purpose of what we're trying to do here this evening. I love to share this image because for, you know, even though it's a little bit of a rough analogy, it helps to communicate that the atmosphere is a thin space. And what we often don't think about when we talk about the atmosphere is that we're really, or the climate system, is that we're really talking about the places on Earth where life can exist, right? The climate system where thermal energy is moving through natural systems of different kinds is really the biosphere. And so we have to think carefully about what that means in all of these different contexts. So I like to start with this kind of image to get our scene set. I also want to take you into this special moment from a few years ago. Some of you, I think, have heard me talk about this, but I've called this the day the world stood still. In an article that's on that website at the bottom left, engageforclimate.org. At the 2018 UN climate negotiations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change presented the findings of its report on the dangers of warming above 1.5 degrees Celsius as a global average surface temperature. And what was really amazing about that moment and in that room was that you had a full plenary session where people didn't get up from their seats and mill around and chatter and take phone calls while other people were speaking into microphones and come in and out and whole delegations leaving to go off to other meetings. Everybody stayed still. It was an incredible and very solemn and almost overwhelming moment. And what's even more amazing about that is that all of these people, as a matter of their profession, have already looked at this information. They were just getting a briefing on the basic executive summary, which they've all seen probably many times. And yet they were still sitting there together in awe. And I think the reason for that is because that was the control room. There was a sense that if no one else is responsible for this, the people in this room are supposed to fix it. It's an incredible challenge. And I think we have to take stock of the fact that those rooms do exist and people are trying to figure out how we get out of this mess. To just get a sense of the crisis that we're in right now, starting from the IPCC's findings, there is a massive difference between a world of 1.5 degrees average surface temperature warming and 2 degrees. And the difference is really between a world that is livable, though challenging, and a world that is riven by chaos, suffering, conflict, migration on a scale we've never seen, hunger at a completely unmanageable rate, and essentially the collapse of entire societies. Ecosystems on every continent are losing biodiversity at an unprecedented rate. I think most of us on this call know that. And this is the sixth mass extinction that's been projected for the last several decades. We're in the midst of it now. We know that we're the cause. On top of this, persistent extreme poverty and worsening income inequality are making these problems worse. It's more difficult for societies to adjust to this kind of challenge or to address this kind of challenge when the means to do so are overly concentrated. And the reason for that is that, not to oversimplify, but it's a fairly solid rule, that the way money moves through societies tends to have to do with the interests of everyone. And if too few people are responsible for the interests of everyone, money can't move enough in order to get society up to speed to deal with the biggest challenges. That's not a situation that sort of modern Western democracies have faced in quite a while, but we are potentially in deep water there. The direct COVID response has already cost the countries of the world more than $10 trillion, probably far more than that if we really go into all the accounting. The United States alone has spent $6 trillion. Global economic losses are projected by Cambridge University to reach more than $70 trillion over the next 5 years. I put this here, again, not for us to despair, but we should take stock. There has never been an economic crisis of this scale in the history of the world before. We have more wealth than we used to. We have more technology and capability than we used to. We're more connected globally. But that doesn't mean that we have what it takes to deal with that challenge. So that has to be part of everybody's context. And on top of that, food insecurity is worsening everywhere. We're expecting now that the number of people living with acute hunger will double this year to more than 260 million. And I want to focus in on our food system for a minute. We often don't think about how the food system serves us because the focus is, do people have enough food? Can they eat? Can they live day to day? And we've done a good job at reducing hunger at that level globally, certainly as a percentage of the population. But every year, 11 million people are dying prematurely because they're not getting the kind of healthy food they need. Food is the leading cause behind our transgressing of 5 of the 9 planetary boundaries that we have to live within if we're going to have a sustainable world. It's also the primary cause of the 6th mass extinction and a major source of carbon emissions. It's also the single largest contributor to global deforestation, overuse of fresh water, and eutrophication of aquatic ecosystems. What that means is the ecosystems become so overly well-fed with nutrients of the wrong kind that the ecosystems eventually collapse. This is how we end up with hypoxic dead zones in the ocean. The food system is gravely harming human and environmental health, and it's undermining the resilience of nations. An estimate last year projected that at least $2 trillion of wealth every single year is lost to the total destructive capacity of our current industrial food system. That projection is very conservative. It's probably far more than that. And there's work ongoing to assess that information. And just recently, less than 2 weeks ago, there was an article in the CNN website. It was co-authored by four people, one of whom was the former Republican Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, who's a medical doctor. And one of the items that they cited in this article that said that the food system is killing us was that 88% of people in the United States, which is the worst affected country by COVID, are metabolically unhealthy. That statistic alone can tell us that there is a major system failure happening in the wealthiest country in the world. And that is something that none of us are going to be able to escape from. The ramifications of that failure are extremely grave. This brings up an important idea. The idea of macro critical resilience. What that essentially means is that there are things that we do in our everyday lives that affect the overall shape and potential of a society or of its economy. We cannot afford to keep pretending that short-term gain at the expense of everything underlying value creation is sustainable. We're going to destroy the things that make societies possible. Macro critical forces are the dynamics of our everyday lives, our economies at all scales, and also of global international relations, peace and security, geopolitics, that determine whether we can survive as a nation. An example of how macro critical resilience is starting to come into the international arena is in 2015, the then managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, said that anything that is macro critical is the IMF's business. And then she cited income inequality, access to education, gender equality, and climate change as four macro critical forces that determine the fate of nations. One of the ways in which the fate of nations is determined is that it turns out if you have two countries that have many similarities, they're more or less the same kind of profile geographically in terms of their economic makeup, their population, but there's one glaring difference. One of those countries educates all young children and the other one persecutes young girls who try to get educated. What you know about that country that persecutes young girls is that it is the single most prevalent indicator that that country will descend into civil war. If that country gives you the same budget projections, the same economic growth projections as the other one, you know it's not true. And so the IMF came to the realization that they had to consider those kind of factors or they would be doing bad math. This is what macro-critical resilience is. Sorry, I have some dogs here that are very excited about who's coming home at the moment. Health and resilience form a continuum, and the importance of that, the fact that health is a fabric that permeates all of the interacting systems that make up our world, that is going to come to define this decade and the next, and perhaps the way the world works in this century, or if we don't do what we need to, the way it doesn't work. So in Citizens Climate, we talk about a livable world. We're building political will for a livable world. And in our international work, we're starting to think about how we can define that a little bit more concretely. In a livable world, climate disruption no longer threatens to undermine the foundations of ecological health and resilience. Prosperity is shared and it's pollution-free. Pollution, regardless of whether a certain business model can create jobs, pollution is impunity. It is a way of doing something that harms others and getting away with it. And not only getting away with it, but in today's economy, profiting from it. However much that might be attractive to people who are used to making money that way, or countries that are used to making a living that way, it's not sustainable in terms of a social contract. And so prosperity needs to be shared and also pollution-free. In a livable world, everyone enjoys the benefits of a world moving towards sustainable prosperity, not just in general, but for everyone. And health has to be accessible to all human minds, bodies, and communities through the experience of everyday life, not as a special privilege for the few, not because one accumulates enough wealth, but just through our organic everyday experience. Now, in terms of planetary health, this image, which I have shared many times, it really resonates with me. Every single time I see this image, it evokes something, and I'm transported to the first time I saw it. Some of you may remember this. It was the first time that a photograph was taken of three tropical cyclones, all of them hurricanes, making landfall simultaneously in the Atlantic Caribbean basin. on the far left, near the just west of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, you see Hurricane Katia. In the middle, you see Hurricane Irma, and on the right, you see Hurricane Jose. And of course, before these three was Harvey, and after was Maria. These were five of the most destructive hurricanes we've ever seen. What you see in the upper right is essentially a way of measuring resilience, knowledge, and knowledge relationships. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but it's there because we need to start translating images like this and experiences like this into an understanding of how prepared we are to actually deal with these things. And I think of that as something very different from basic, you know, climate preparedness or climate adaptation or building walls against sea level rise. This is a different kind of understanding that we're looking for. If we start to think about what happens when those hurricanes make landfall, we have to think about how it affects human beings. And the question of whether we know what we're doing, whether we have intelligence about the systems of which our planetary biosphere is made, is an increasingly important question. The field of climate science, as I think most of you know, is one of the most robust, interdisciplinary, interactive, and well-documented areas of scientific inquiry in the history of the world. We know what we're doing in that sense, but in terms of how ready we are to adapt all of our behaviors to a world in which, unfortunately, we have more control over the direction of those natural systems than we would like to, we may not know exactly what we're doing. And how our ability to perform in this epoch, when we have such a heavy influence over natural systems, how that affects human development is going to be one of the defining characteristics of this century. I don't think it's something that we can treat as an ideological issue or a partisan issue or a perspective that some people care about and other people ignore. It's going to be built into everybody's lives in a way that today's politics doesn't really reflect. Just like in the year 2000, there were no smartphones, and so they were not built into anyone's lives. But we've gone through a paradigm shift. Thinking about human development in the context of planetary health and resilience is an absolutely critical part of all of our planning. And in the context of COVID and all of the setbacks that it has given us, the food system disruption, the need for businesses to become more resilient, we have to understand those connections. So all that we do not see, the idea here is we're not used to looking for a lot of this information. We're not used to thinking about the human experience as equivalent to, you know, that of the butterfly whose wings affect weather patterns on the other side of the planet, actually trying to know about that, caring to know about that, and understanding that there might be ethical implications to it. We're not accustomed to thinking of our role in the world that way, but that's where we are now, essentially. And so I like to think about the question of whether we do or don't know what's happening in relation to our economy, vis-a-vis natural systems and our impact on them, in terms of what Buckminster Fuller said about human intelligence. He said the human brain is nature's most powerful anti-entropy engine, meaning that we don't have to accept that good things disappear, that order unravels, that natural systems will collapse. We can be more sustainable than that. But if we're going to do that, the purpose of the text you see in front of you here is to say, we need economic understanding that is deeper and more complex, more interactive, more rapidly evolving than we have ever had before. And part of that story is to say, it's not us, the ordinary people, against the experts. It's not a question of whether, you know, technocrats are going to dictate to us based on their expertise what we should be doing. It's actually a question of a basic right. We have a right to know whether the choices we're making are good or bad. We have a right to accumulate knowledge about the state of the world, accumulate knowledge about the nature of our activities, the nature of our choices. We have a right to accumulate knowledge about who is putting those choices in front of us and whether they're somehow trying to game the system that we live in so that our choices are more limited or more vicious or more destructive than they should be or than they would be if our values were at play. And you know, today I was, along with others, part of a big conversation about connecting across the divide between people who want to fight climate change and people who deny its importance. But that's not the divide. The divide really is between people who understand that every human being has a fundamental right to seek and obtain truthful, evidence-based knowledge, and then to act based on their values as a result of that knowledge, and people who simply assume that whatever they feel is right is enough. That is the divide that we're trying to overcome at this moment in history. And I think when we worry, as many of us do, about the deep disruptions happening in democratic societies across the world, this is one of the things we have to be thinking about: the right to know. The late Congressman John Lewis, the great civil rights leader, in one of his last speeches, said that the right to know whether we are having a good or bad effect on the environment, whether we are putting things in our bodies that are healthy, is a fundamental human right that is unalienable. Our society doesn't think that way, but we have to think that way because our society was designed to let us think that way. A world that works, a livable world, has to work for everyone. And so I just want to highlight here a specific point at the top, that if we treat food, income, education, air and water quality, and the right to access information as distinct and isolated concerns, we are going to make inequality, environmental risk, and basic human suffering worse. And we're going to undermine the ability that we have to resist those things, to counter those things, to seek redress for grievances, to correct injustices. And what we know, what we're seeing play out right now in the COVID context, is that that inability to correct injustices carries a massive, catastrophic, and potentially existential cost to society. We cannot afford not to treat systemic injustices as something that can be and should be corrected, and we cannot afford to let the opportunity to do that slip away. So one of the principles that I think we need to have in mind as we deal with the COVID context, think about how it interacts with other crises, and then seek to transcend that crisis, is to think that a world that works, works for everyone. If it doesn't, it's not working. These things come back to bite us. And we can maybe distill all of this into the simple idea that better has value. I think everybody understands that implicitly. Kindergartners understand that. People competing on a playing field understand that. But our economics sometimes say it's the other way around. They say that cheaper is better. Cheaper is more valuable. And that is because it depends on who it serves, and it depends on what our goal is in terms of achieving a good outcome. That idea that the cheapest business model, which is really the cheapest for those who run it, not for everyone else, the idea that that is the best business model is against the idea that better is more valuable. Better in all the senses, better in the way that it is good for people, good for the planet, ethical, and also conducive to good outcomes. I think many of us assume that because most people are decent and try to do good things in the world, that our world works in a way where the better outcome is the more valued outcome. But at the level of our systemic infrastructure as a global civilization, that is not exactly true. There's a kind of clash between the idea that the most good for the most people is best, and the idea that everyone is entitled to better outcomes and to be able to pursue their dreams and to be able to pursue happiness. If we're going to get to that better world, and we're going to try to learn, you know, what it is we know and don't know about how we're doing, we need information. And this is one example. This is a global knowledge graph of knowledge connections, meaning people, entities, crisis situations, response scenarios that are known to coincide in published reports of different kinds across about 20 different variables of sustainability and resilience. I won't go through them at the moment. And these are some emblematic subgraphs that you see on the right side. The graph is called the WEAVE network graph. WEAVE stands for Whole Earth Active Value Economy. And what it's saying to us, first of all, is there's a lot of complexity out there. And then it's also saying on the right side, there's wide variation in who knows how much about that. And when you consider that that complexity is going to tell us about our survival and our potential for future prosperity, the complexity of these graphs matters. This one that's circled, this sort of shark fin, has only 4 points. It's the weakest resilience knowledge graph or weave knowledge graph in this particular system. It happens to correspond to an industrial food corporation. I won't name it, but the projection that the graph gives you is that this company probably doesn't know enough to withstand major shocks in this highly connected interactive world that we're in right now. Maybe 100 years ago, but not now. And what you see right below it is the graph corresponding to the United States Supreme Court. You can see clearly that there's an imbalance there. The court is better prepared to judge whether or not this company has honored its obligations to society than the company itself is. That's not a good position to be in. I'm just going to put this text up there that kind of distills some of this. I'll also point out that that starburst, that green starburst graph on the lower right, that's the United States. And the reason all those lines are coming in is because it's the most connected place in the world in terms of resilience knowledge. There's a problem when that place has companies with no resilience knowledge and leaders with not only no resilience knowledge, but who are actively opposed to making us essentially safer and more prosperous. It's a problem, but it's a problem that goes back to these other things I'm talking about. How much do we know about what we're doing and where we're going? We have to embrace complexity. It's a big world. There are a lot of people in it, and everybody's doing different things with different motivations. And it's starting to turn out that the way we interact with each other and with the earth creates a geophysical fabric that represents the ethics of our world. How good are we to each other? How well are we treating each other? Are we honoring a social contract that makes more good possible or not? The COVID crisis is revealing that the hidden costs of not building resilience are far greater than we ever imagined. If you would have asked a year ago, what are the hidden costs to society of a country where 88% of people are metabolically unhealthy? The general answer would be somewhere in the area of what the healthcare costs are and somewhere in the area of whether people's life expectancy is shortened. And our life expectancy in the US has been getting shorter because of this food health problem over the last several years. But they wouldn't have been able to tell you that the United States would spend more money in a couple of months than it normally spends in a year as a government. They would not have, that insight would not have existed. So this is a revelation that the world is grappling with. It also means that we've gotten much closer than we much sooner than we expected to that moment when all investment has to be resilience building investment. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. It goes to what Brett was mentioning before about the Resilience Intel Initiative. But there's a basic insight that I think we can take from these converging crises. When the world is this complex and the stakes are this high and we're finding ourselves in such a deep hole, it turns out that current bottom line on your screen, being cleaner, more sustainable, more resource efficient, more equitable in your strategy and investment choices, will greatly increase your chances of success, because society is going to find a way to, in the terms of sort of brute capitalism, is going to find a way to weaponize the data that I was showing you in that network graph. If you're one of the entities that is generating massive unaccounted costs for everyone else is going to try to stop you from prospering and favor those who build value and build resilience. And that's because the planet and humanity itself require that we get better on this. Now, if we're embracing complexity, I want to just point out that complex weave network graph that looks like a tumbleweed and that encompasses all the things that make life possible on Earth. That's maybe too much complexity for most of us to think of as actionable. It's a data visualization. But the Sustainable Development Goals, which were agreed 3 months before the Paris Agreement in 2015, they actually distill that complexity in a very actionable way. You have, I mean, 17 sounds like a lot of goals, but if we really think about what this is all for, it's a very useful map of how we get to a world that is healthy, just, sustainable, and prosperous. We have to move towards all of these things in all societies, and we have to do it collaboratively across borders, internationally, help each other do it. We also have to do it within our borders at all levels, not just nationally, but also regionally, provincially, at city level, community, and ideally households are seeing direct benefits from all of these goals being national priorities and international priorities. And what's amazing is that all 193 countries of the United Nations General Assembly agreed that they would do that. They agreed in September of 2015 in New York that over the next 15 years, they would work collectively and independently to achieve all 17 of these goals together, globally, and also domestically at all levels. I go through that because it's quite astonishing. It's an incredibly comprehensive global development agenda. Now, the way that we think about how we can contribute to this as Citizens Climate, when we engage in the intergovernmental process through the United Nations, the main place we do that is at the COP, the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was agreed in 1992. Our agenda in the COP process has evolved. It's gotten a little bit more complex, and now each of the elements is actually its own sort of platform. But we've identified these five areas as things that the governments of the world need to be able to address if they're going to solve climate change. And each of these areas is somewhere where we can do the thing that we do in Citizens Climate, which is to not only empower citizen volunteers to build political will, but to use their energy and their work, their efforts, their relationships that they're building to empower people in government to do more to solve this problem. We need more participation at all levels, but especially at the intergovernmental level. There isn't a democratic process at the international level, but there are opportunities for stakeholder engagement that make it possible to really move mountains, essentially, in climate action in terms of moving cities, which then move countries, which then move each other, which get us to the point where we agree to 1.5 degrees as a global target instead of 2. We need more of that because the outcomes have always been better when we have more of that. On dividends, carbon fee and dividend legislation, we are actually forming an international alliance called the Climate Dividend Alliance, working with the CleanTech 21 Foundation in Switzerland, with the support of the Swiss government and other partners in collaboration with the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition to focus on how carbon dividends or climate dividend frameworks, different types of carbon dividend policies, can actually be the way that national climate plans get to full steam, find the investment they need, and work climate transformation quickly to effect. On finance, the Resilience Intel Initiative is meant to shift all finance everywhere to climate smart priorities. And I'll come back to that in a minute. We've identified watersheds or watersheds and nature as a kind of a way of integrating the interactions across the climate system and the biosphere through the cryosphere, across watersheds, down through the landscape, down to the ocean and into ocean ecosystems. And then the work that we're doing on food systems and the Food System Economics Commission, this is increasingly part of our international organizing in Citizens Climate because everybody's fate is connected to the food system and everybody's everyday activity through the food system is affecting the planet and it's affecting everyone else's possibilities. So these five areas are how we want to try to move the world in terms of climate resilience through the global negotiations. Now, the world is at a crossroads. We have a crisis of epic proportions, just in the climate space, but also across the biosphere generally, and then through societies as we've just looked at. And we know that we need to do these things. We need national transformation in all these areas. We need climate smart investment and development. We need to reduce risk and enhance the sharing of benefits. And we need diplomatic cooperation, which is a challenge. But there's a way in which I think we can find common ground across many different types of ideologies, even at the global level, by thinking about how geopolitics and Main Street interact. And I don't just mean Main Street USA. I mean how local communities everywhere are affected by and also have an effect on geopolitics. This is one of those areas, kind of like the economic problem of GDP, where the general thinking is, at that high level, you just deal with ordinary people indirectly. You don't think about the individual people and their ability to function virtuously in the world as having an inherently powerful impact on our overall potential as a world. But we have to start thinking that way, or we're not really going to be able to emerge from these crises. The COVID response itself has to also think that way. So we know that there are some problems with the way international trade works. We know that favoring the lowest cost to business can often lower standards, harm the environment, undermine human rights and democracy, and has all kinds of negative outcomes. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be interacting as a world. What it means is we need better geopolitics. If we focus on the things that make that possible and we focus on the things that that better geopolitics is going to give us, we have a world full of, sorry, I didn't mean to skip over that. See if I can get back to that slide. We have a world full of possibility. And this is something that I just want to share as a window into that possibility. The Resilience Intel Initiative has spent a couple of years aggregating all of the commitments that have been made to climate smart investment of different kinds. Just across these five sectors, and there are other kinds of climate smart investment that have been put forward. These are hard commitments. These are not commitments that say a percentage of what we earn will go to this. This is dollar value commitments. So even though the general wealth of the world has declined, and even though there are places where if you're reliant on a percentage of revenue or a percentage of a business's profits or something like that, you're going to see a decline in investment potential. These commitments have not, in theory at least, declined because for two reasons. One, they were dollar value commitments. And two, the best way that that money can be used is towards the climate smart resilience building future economy. That's the highest value, highest payoff way that that money can be invested. So we have more than $6 trillion sitting around waiting to go to work. And every policymaker everywhere in the world has to be thinking about that right now, because money is scarce and getting scarcer. Rebuilding for a better future. That's what we've called this lesson. But what's about to come through here is that after months of discussion about the COVID crisis and how it interacts with all these different variables, we've come through to a rough list. It's not a final list, but it's a projection of principles for how we can rebuild from the crisis situation that we're in for a better future, or build back better, as many people say. First of all, we're all in it, and everybody's agency has value for everyone else. The more you can do, the better that is for me, and vice versa. And we have to start thinking that way as a global community, not just in our smaller groups or in our preferred groups. Leaving no one behind, that's sort of the motto of the Sustainable Development Goals, but we have to also flip that around and say that means everybody is part of the future. Those two, we are all future builders, and leave no one behind, reinforce each other, and we have to consciously honor both of those principles. We have to design the things we're doing, whether we're designing laws or designing cars or designing computers, or whether we're designing economic models, we have to design so that we transcend crisis, so that we can understand that these crises that are happening to us now are not only possible, but they can also get worse. And then we put things in place that are going to help us avoid that damage in the future. That's going to be the biggest investment opportunity in the history of the world, not just the climate problem, but actually designing our way out of this multifaceted crisis. And then honoring the resilience imperative. In a lot of ways, until recently, resilience has been seen as a kind of talking point or a nice idea or a utopian idea. Well, the world is dangerous, but resilience would be nice to have. It's not a luxury, it's an imperative. And it should be one of the things we think of as a right. When you have governments that are there to serve you, and even in a country, in a system where the government doesn't honor that principle, that's still their obligation. They have a responsibility to build resilience. And we have to start thinking carefully about that. And then finally, in this century, as we emerge from this crisis, we're going to be defining this century. And we need to redefine health so that we are understanding health as human health, economic health, planetary health, the health of the social contract, the health of our access to information. These things are inextricably connected to each other, but also to justice, prosperity, and whether or not we can access a world where all of those moving pieces reinforce and benefit each other so that we're better and better off all the time. All societies have been formulated so that in theory, that's where they're going to go. But eventually societies collapse because they don't end up honoring that principle. We have an opportunity, an unprecedented opportunity to do that, to see this multi-system interactive health and resilience as the human priority. We have the ability to do that. We have a need to do it. And the opportunity to prosper from doing it is right in front of us. So I'd like to put that forward and put these five principles forward as standards for our time. I just want to quickly review that the learning objectives here today are to explore the convergence and complexity of all of this, our context, to understand resilience and how it translates into opportunity, and to envision a livable future that's not just livable and prosperous, but where collaboration and co-creation are a normal part of our everyday world. In a way that they're still not yet. You know, I think we're starting to see that. We're starting to visualize that. And one of our colleagues in Citizen Climate, Tammy Kellogg, has been very eloquent in saying that power is being decentralized. And that is one of the reasons that there's a lot of tension in the world right now, because power doesn't want to be relinquished from where it is. But the natural outcome of human beings coming together, learning more, interacting, cooperating, is that we're going to be able to do that. And we still have to formulate what that looks like. So I just like to put to each of you, whether you want to do it now or whether you want to just reserve this for later on, think about what all of this means to you in terms of the exploration of our world, your understanding of this complexity, and then also, how would you envision that kind of future prosperity, not just globally, like we've solved climate change or where everybody, there's no poverty, that kind of thing. But also locally, what is local life like in communities you know, but maybe also in communities you don't know? How would you imagine good outcomes for people in those places? I just like to say, try to do that thought exercise at some point. I think it will be valuable for gaining perspective into all of the converging crises. And maybe a final point I would make, there are people right now in all countries that are hungry, whose rights are not being respected, who are marginalized, who do not have economic opportunity, who do not have access to education at the level probably most of us on this call have had. And part of the reason for that is that the structure of the societies that they are in, including the one that we're living in, is designed in a way where it doesn't really matter at the system level if some people are left out. There are things that you can do locally to help solve those problems. And what I would say is, you can think about those opportunities to do for others also as opportunities to learn about how the world gets better when we solve these problems, because that experience is related to the experience that we're going to have if we succeed in making a world that is just and sustainable, where everybody's included.
Here is to that, Joe. I couldn't agree more. I know that everyone here in the chat has just really resonated with all that you've shared tonight. And again, just really, you're getting a lot of love. Just really want to uplift the importance of the wisdom that you've shared and the connections that you're helping build throughout our whole network, Joe. And just getting a window into a little bit of that work with all these links and helpful resources is really empowering and motivating. Thank you all for being on the line. And we hope that you found tonight's training useful and empowering.
I'd just like to say thank you all for putting your time into this, for being here, and also for the work that you do every day. It really does matter. And these five different areas of work that are on the screen, these are things you will be able to follow up with us on in relation to our international work on the way to COP26, which is still over a year away.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.